Hey everyone, it's Matt Anderson, and you're listening to the Proximity Process Podcast, a show that's all about the idea that change starts with us. And I'm excited to bring you today's episode because that's really what it's about. It's about change starting with my guest. So what I wanted to do with this is I wanted to come back to the conversation we've been having on the show about termination of parental rights. So I did a few episodes, two with Corey Best, one with Kathleen Kramer, that circled around TPR. And I thought it'd be interesting to come back to that with somebody who is a practitioner that works for a child welfare agency and, you know, is really confronted with the decision on a regular daily basis about terminating parental rights. And so today's guest, who I'm excited to bring to you, is Molly Warren. She's the Director of Children and Family Services at Boulder County in Colorado. With this episode and all of these episodes, what I'm trying to do here is really just normalize a conversation about TPR. Should we be using it? And the question that Corey sparked for us is, what if TPR was no longer an option? What if we took it off the table altogether? What opportunities might that create for us? And that's some of what Molly and I get into, that what if question. But where we started was, I think, a really interesting place. For Molly, coming into her role and into her work, TPR, it was just the norm, meaning that the use of termination of parental rights, it just goes unquestioned. It was, for her, it was part of the culture, it was part of the day-to-day practice. Then Molly has this experience and she starts to question, why is TPR the norm? Should it be the norm? And very recently, that question has put her on a new path, on a new process. And that's exactly where we pick up today's conversation. You've been in child welfare for a long time. You sit in a senior leadership role over a county child welfare agency in Colorado. So you have a lot of context here and a lot of experience. When we were talking about this, you mentioned that there was always this kind of thought that termination of parental rights is the norm rather than an option.
I had feelings about adoption and how that impacted kids, because as we all know, it can have profound impacts on kids. And I had, frankly, had always thought of TPR, termination of parental rights, as almost a checkbox to get to adoption. I wasn't focused on TPR. I was focused on kind of where the child's permanency will be. So I've had probably four or five moments in my career like this where just, it's like you remember where you were standing at the time, right? And things just crystallize really beautifully. And for me, it was September of this year, listening to this podcast, listening to Corey say, what if we didn't do TPR? And I was loading groceries into the trunk of my car in the grocery store before a Broncos game. Like, that is like how specific, right, that experience was for me. And it rocked me, because I realized I had never even thought about a world without TPR. Once I started to think about it, I couldn't stop thinking about it. And I've really been on a pretty significant journey around that since then.
So you're unpacking groceries from the car, getting ready for the Broncos game, and you hear Corey Best say, what if TPR was not an option? I'm curious on two levels. Like, what were the feelings in your body when you started to ask yourself that question? And then what were the thoughts that started to come from that? You know, and that may have been like reflections of past decisions that you were part of to terminate parental rights, or you started to go into the curiosities around the question. But what were the feelings that you were having when that question came up?
I felt excited and, like, I think just hopeful about possibilities. I felt a bit of relief. The idea that it didn't exist would make so much of my work easier, actually, or the work that we're trying to do in the agency that I sit within. So those are the feelings. And then there are just so many questions, right? Because it's such a paradigm shift that I immediately went into all of the possibilities, the considerations. You know, I really live in the meso kind of level of our work. So I get, I think, the best of both worlds when it comes to social work. I get the macro policy work that is potentially incredibly radical or reforming. And then I also get to really help guide folks to think about those micro interactions differently. And so I immediately started thinking about what that would look like, both from a policy perspective and in practice, you know, in my county with my staff, with our respondent parent council, right? Like all of our stakeholders and how they would respond to it. But I got really excited and started having conversations immediately.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. So I definitely want to, get into some of that, that what if, and like where your imagination took you and where those conversations went. If we stick with the feelings for a minute, the feeling that you mentioned of relief, you'd never really considered, you know, what if TPR didn't exist? And what if it is an option that we have some choice around that had never really occurred to you? It's just this presumed part of the practice that we do. So a sense of relief, like a relief from what, do you think?
So my personal values and professional values have long been pretty far to the family preservation side of our work, and maintaining family connections, ensuring that children have relationship with their parents. And even if that relationship can't be their primary caregiver, right, that they are connected either with parents or with family. And we have so many conversations about the best interests of the child around being adopted by the adoptive parents or the foster family that they have lived with for the last 2 years, which is often the entirety of their life, versus perhaps we've been able to locate a kinship family that the child doesn't know, but is very excited and hopeful and wanting to raise a member of their family, and which of those two options or situations is better. And for a very long time, I think we have looked at that situation through too small of a lens. So we look at this 2-year-old and we decide what's best for them. But that 2-year-old is going to be 12 someday or 13 someday or 17 someday. And what is best for that 13-year-old, for that 17-year-old? Is it still to be, you know, in this adoptive home? Or even though the transition from one to the other will certainly be difficult for the 2-year-old, you know, is that harm or risk worth, because it will be hard. I want to just acknowledge that little ones have a hard time transitioning, but is it essentially worth it? And that's, for me, all of the work in child welfare is weighing harm and then deciding which of the options is the least harmful. I think we've gotten it wrong for a really long time. Like we've not understood, and we understand so much more deeply now, truly, what harm looks like, not just from abuse and neglect, but from our systems interventions. And so the conversation has just for so long been, which is better? And I have forever thought that we need to fight for the 12-year-old, 13-year-old, 14-year-old. And that has been difficult. And I think the relief was, if in a world that there, you know, was no TPR, would that fight feel easier? Would it become easier? Would it be possible for more kids to first be with family? Or would it be possible to not close the door on their family, right? Which is right. What TPR does.
It's interesting, you know, where you're going with that, because as I just think about it from my own experiences working in foster care and adoption over the years, termination of parental rights as a pathway to adoption feels like it's giving us options. To what end, right? And this is where, like, if we're focused on short-term outcomes measured by federal requirements and organizational culture and financial incentives, like there's a lot of push towards adoption as the outcome because of those factors. So then TPR and adoption feels like we're opening up options for permanency as the gold standard outcome. But it's interesting if we think about eliminating termination of parental rights as opening up a whole new door to a whole new set of options. So it's like termination of parental rights is not a tool that creates options. It's actually a constraint. It would open up a whole new world of options that then gets us less myopic, because I think that's what it is. When we think about what's the best interest for the 4-year-old, 5-year-old, 13-year-old, we're not thinking about the 25-year-old version of that child or their parents, their extended family, their community, their ancestors even, that have potentially been impacted by these systems. yeah, it feels like it creates more options for us.
You ask this question all the time, but who does TPR benefit, really? And I would argue more than anyone, it benefits adoptive families who want to grow their family. Because after TPR and adoption, case is closed. You ride off into the sunset as a family. And, you know, APR, allocation of parental rights, is far messier than that because it leaves the door open. But it also, the flip side of that is that it allows us to be so much more creative about relationships and connection for the child or for the young person.
Yeah, you mentioned when we were talking before, allocation of parental rights or APR. I'd never heard of this before. I am interested in what this is and what it might add to this conversation. So can you take a couple of minutes and just maybe, if we can, ground in that case example and what is APR?
Sure. So just very technically first, in Colorado, we kind of have three major options for permanency for kids. So adoption, which I think we're all pretty familiar with. Guardianship is kind of on the other end of the continuum. And guardianship is really rare. The families that we work with, for a lot of reasons, it's by far the most strenuous, if you will, for the caregivers. And so it's just not something that we tend to do. And then allocation of parental rights, which is also known as permanent custody, is another way to think about it, is kind of in the middle, and I think is often the sweet spot for finding permanency for kids. So allocation of parental rights doesn't require termination. In a perfect world, in the best scenarios, parental consent is included in the decision-making. However, we do sometimes have contested hearings for allocation of parental rights. So we would like to give custody, let's say, to an aunt, and the parent, in the best cases, says, yes, I agree. Like, I'd love for my sister to take care of my children for now. And, you know, in other instances, says, no, I don't want this. But for whatever reason, you know, we as the system, as the agency, feel strongly that the parent can't safely parent their children right now. So it really is about kind of a couple of things. It's about physical custody and then decision making. So it gives that caregiver full physical custody and or decision making for, you know, medical things and school things and all the things that you need to parent a kiddo. One of the things that's really lovely about APR is that it can be either like solo or joint. And so what we have seen in some of the best solutions we've come up with to ensure safety for a kiddo and permanency for a kiddo is APR, allocation of parental rights, to both, let's say, a grandmother who is very, very safe, and also a parent who perhaps is struggling with substance abuse and can't do it on their own, but together with grandma, right, as kind of a check and balance for what the child needs, especially if it's a very young and vulnerable child, can be a really nice arrangement for everyone. So it opens up so many options. It is different though. There's one piece in particular that I think we as a system and the individuals within the system get really organized around, which is that in Colorado, at least every 2 years, or if something really changes and is dangerous to the child, so that's like kind of the one caveat, every 2 years, the APR can be challenged or questioned. And so there's a belief that, especially for very young children, like 0 to 5 is where in Boulder County, where we see the most termination and adoption, because I think the belief is this is such a young child, you know, perhaps they've only ever known their foster family as their primary caregiver. And so, you know, true permanence is that adoption and like closing and really not interacting with the system again, unless they want to. Whereas if we, you know, did something like APR, there is a possibility that when the child is 4 or 6 or 8, someone could come back and challenge that custody arrangement and change the permanency for the child, change the caregiver for the child. But here's the thing about, from where I sit, if a parent were, let's say, I'm just going to continue to use substance abuse, but if a parent were to be struggling with that so significantly that they couldn't safely care for their child, you know, over years, over 4 years, over 6 years, is able to, you know, really work through that and get to a place where they can safely parent their child, and the child is now older and less vulnerable, and they're able to challenge that custody arrangement and get their child back, wouldn't that be a good thing?
Yeah, why is that a bad thing?
Exactly. And so that's kind of where it lives for us.
Yeah. I was going to ask, you know, why is this different than guardianship? And in some ways it's not, but is it every 2 years that the case or the decision for APR is reviewed? Or is it like every 2 years there's a window of opportunity to, I don't know, is it petitioning the court for review of custody? And
so, yes, it's not mandatory or obligatory, the review, just if it is. My understanding, and this is something that we would need to ask one of my attorneys for, to be honest, I think that the child has to have lived with the person for 6 months or been like the biological parent to challenge it. That's my understanding. I could be wrong. The only caveat to that, I think anyone can petition the court if there's a concern for the child's safety. But again, right. Why is that a bad thing? So
right. Yeah, there's part of the norm around TPR and adoption. Kathleen Kramer talked about this in her episode. Part of the norm is this presumption that it's the most secure, the most permanent outcome. And I think she was questioning that. Like, is there really much of a difference in real terms between, say, guardianship and adoption? Her perspective as an attorney is there really wasn't much difference there. But I think that, like, for me, like, these things always should be in question. Like, is an adoption always totally secure? And it's not, because we know that kids are adopted and they come back into foster care, or, you know, those relationships don't persist over the long term. And at some point, it's quite often that family starts to extend beyond the adoptive family. At some point, that child says, well, now I need to know who my people are, where I came from, who am I? Like, the most important fundamental human questions start to arise the older you get. And it may happen at 15, 25, 35. I told a story a couple times on this show where, you know, we had somebody when I was at Children's Home Society come in at 80 years old saying, I need to find my people before I die. Like, these are fundamental human questions that never go away. And I think that where termination of parental rights and adoption as a constraint is that it almost disregards those questions. And in some cases, it does intentionally disregard those questions. Now, it depends on the openness of the people involved around that adoption. But oftentimes, there's no space for those questions of who am I? Where did I come from? And I think that's, I don't know, I'm curious what you think about that. But for me, that feels problematic.
Yeah, deeply problematic. Mm-hmm. I agree. I have this vision, and it's perhaps a bit ambitious, but I think that, I guess I get curious. What if the entire system viewed the role of foster parents and permanent caregivers really differently? What if instead of this child that needs, you know, a safe and caring home right now will be a part of our family forever and not a part of their other family? What if it was, we are going to love and care for this child. They are going to become a part of our family, but they will also be a part of their own family as much as is safely possible. And we will be here for them in whatever way they need for as long as they need. And it wasn't this permanency in that the child could never go home, but it was permanency in that they knew that there was a loving and caring family that was there for them that was also really interested in serving the true best interest of the child, right? Which is to have a relationship with their own family and to maintain those ancestral connections and to know their biological parents, their parents, as deeply as they can really safely do. Because there are, especially with really young children, and this is perhaps where things get more complicated being in the system, right? But there are times where parents, adults are dealing with things that do prohibit them from safely caring for their children in that instance. But that doesn't mean that that is the way that their life or their situation will be forever. And so what if we got more comfortable with a more fluid situation, with a foundation of children who are, you know, really grounded in the fact that they know that there will be, they have the security and the attachment of knowing that there'll be someone there that will always be there for them.
Because the reality is, I mean, so much of why we do what we do, not just in this system, but in so many different parts of our lives, we do what makes those with the most power comfortable. You know, I sat in a powerful position. You sit in a powerful position. A lot of people do. And we make decisions around what makes us most comfortable. So it's uncomfortable to be in the fluidity, as you say, like it's uncomfortable to be in the fluidity of relationships, right? And so when we're thinking about permanency for kids in foster care, we're thinking about what would make us comfortable in terms of getting to that place. The reality is, though, for the child, for their parents, for this family, this community, it doesn't matter what the permanency outcome is. The fluidity is there regardless, because you're not in control of what's happening. You know, other people are making all these decisions. And I think that part of normalizing this conversation around what if termination of parental rights didn't exist, what if that option went away, it would be us getting more comfortable with the options that that creates, the fluidity that that creates. And we'd have to have a different sort of North Star, you know, federally defined permanency outcome that we get measured on does not remain as the North Star anymore, but family integrity might become a North Star. There's a lot of discomfort in this work that you know, we need to hold our share of it too, I think.
I agree. What if what the research and the outcomes and the years of talking to kids who have been in foster care or kids who are adopted, what if what's best for them was North Star, right? And their parents, because let's be clear, we heard it in Corey's story. It is harmful. This termination of parental rights is not harmful just for the child. It's harmful for the entire family system. It's harmful for the parents. And so what if it was just what's best for the people that mm-hmm. we're working with?
Yeah. So let's go back to that moment where you're unpacking mm-hmm. the groceries and getting ready for the Broncos game. As a Steelers fan, I'm okay with the Broncos, so we can have this conversation. So you're unpacking the groceries and these feelings are coming up. And one was of excitement because you hadn't really entertained the idea before that this is an option. There is a what if scenario here. So that excitement led to some thoughts and to some conversations. Let's spend some time there. Like, what were some of those what if ideas? Like, where did your imagination go when you started to think, wow, like, what if this was an option? What if we could do things differently?
So I think there was actually a third emotion that I didn't name, and I think I didn't recognize it until this moment. There was also fear, and the fear was not around the idea. Like, I knew that I could start to unpack this notion of, you know, no TPR or, you know, a vastly reduced TPR. That was not the fear. The fear was how the people in my system, specifically in Boulder County, were going to respond when I said, what if we start thinking about this way? Or if, when I started questioning or challenging why TPR was necessary, that I got a little bit of a pit in my stomach.
Yeah. What do you think that is? Like, where's that fear coming from? It's something within you that is afraid of something. What do you think that is?
Probably a lot of like internalized good girl syndrome. I mean, truly, I think there's some socialization there for women, but also, you know, it's a dance in my role, right? Because, we have a vision, and I really believe that folks get into this field because they want to help. Like, no one gets into our field to harm. And if we are going to really reform the system in a radical way and, you know, disrupt it, we have to start to think about things differently. Implicit in that is that we have to help people understand that perhaps how we've always done it hasn't been the best. And that is deeply painful for people who are doing this work because they care. And it doesn't mean it's not harmful. It doesn't mean we're not going to do it. But I think that's the pit, is how do we get from here to there, because we know it's what's best.
Is the pit, like, if I just put myself in your shoes, is the pit like, is Molly going to be okay if Molly starts to say things like, I think we should consider what it would look like if TPR didn't exist. I think we should acknowledge the harms that we've perpetuated on people, and that those might be bold, disruptive, make people uncomfortable, in a way that I'm not sure if I'm ready to be that uncomfortable to make others uncomfortable. Like, is that part of, no? Okay. Yeah.
No, the decision was easy. Like, it's in line with my values. I think this is actually what it is. And I'll use your language for it. It was, how can I do this in a way that allows me to be in right relationship with what I now know is true and with the people that I serve as their leader? So how am I going to remain connected with them? How am I going to have these conversations without isolating or ostracizing them or pushing them so far so quickly that I hurt them or that they're not willing to come along or consider? You know, here's the irony of the whole thing. Everyone that I've talked to in Boulder County about this has been like, yes, let's think about this. And, you know, I think we're nowhere near where we need to be in terms of this. And we can talk about kind of like that whole process, but no one flipped. No one was angry. People had questions. People, you know, would push back or challenge, but like everything was discussion based.
So let's paint a picture here. So who did you go to in some of those first conversations? Like, you don't have to name them, but like, mm-hmm. you know, people within your organization, leaders, I would imagine, like, who did you go to and what did you say to them to like, mm-hmm. to start this conversation?
I was meeting with one of our permanency supervisors or ongoing supervisors. And I just was like, okay, this one's really crazy, but I think they're kind of used to me like bringing these slightly, I think they feel absurd at the time, at the moment, right? Like these just like very different ideas or paradigms there. And I just kind of was like, what if, right? And why do we think, and it really it was about questions, right? Like, why is TPR better than APR? You know, how can we think about that? And no one was like, TPR is the North Star. We have to do this. It was really like, you know, a lot of concern about permanency for kids, not different than what Kathleen said, because of this 2-year thing. I think that there's kind of a feeling or a belief that the child will not kind of emotionally or mentally have full security if that can always be challenged. Ongoing or permanency supervisor, then all the permanency supervisors, then my managers. And that was all like very casual. Like I was just kind of like testing the water, but it went so well. I reached out to our head county attorney and said, I want to have this conversation. I want to understand it more deeply because that was the first piece. Just by happenstance, and this is probably why I didn't have these feelings about TPR, I've never been involved in a TPR in a meaningful way other than as a leader to, mm-hmm. you know, staff and discuss.
Sure. Meaningful way.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Because you have to approve and, you know, those sorts of things. But sorry, keep going.
No, you're totally right. Yes. And we take those decisions super, super seriously. Yeah. You know, it's not that. I think like as a caseworker, I never did it. And that feels different. I don't know. Because I think I draw so much on my experience as a caseworker, as a leader, that, you know, that means something to me. Anyhow, so asked her to meet. She sent me some resources in advance so I could kind of get really, really granular about the differences and make sure that there weren't things that I wasn't aware of or things like that. And then we met for an hour. And this has been pretty recently, a couple of weeks ago, really. And I was probably like a little bit of the pit again, like not sure what she would think. And she was really open to the conversation. And I mean, essentially she was like, yes. And right. Like we got to figure it out. I don't think we've landed. I don't think that I want to be really clear. Like we have not said we are done with TPR in Boulder County or anything like that. But I think that where we are now that I'm really excited about is we're ready to begin having these conversations and these discussions more broadly, more intentionally and systemically, which I think is the first step in changing the individuals that are in the system. Which is how, you know, really at that meso level, we create change. And, you know, I'm in a really progressive place. My county is deeply committed to honoring families, respecting families, family preservation whenever possible, and race equity work, which is a huge part of this that we haven't named yet. And I looked a little bit. So just for, I guess, maybe like scope and scale for us and to, I think, provide some perspective for how much this would change our work. We get like 6,000 referrals, like calls from the community a year. And Of that, we assign about 1,600 for assessment. So kind of that, what I think a lot of people call it an investigation, we don't. And then of that 1,600, about 1,000 become cases. So that's kind of like in a year. Court data is almost impossible to get. It's often tracked by hand, which is, I think, a whole nother conversation. So I actually got data from our Office of Respondent Parent Counsel, from the parents' attorneys, because I think they've done the best job of tracking all of this, which makes good sense, right?
Makes sense.
That's who their clients. Yeah, it just totally begs the question of who are we serving? Yeah. But so in Boulder, in the last 5 years, so 2017 to 2023, we've had 381 court cases total. So of that 1,000 a year, 300, so, you know, divide 381 by five, essentially. And then in that 5 years, we terminated parental rights on 81 families.
Okay.
So that's about 16 a year, if you do the math. That means we're TPRing 1% of the families that we actually intervene with, which is small and still has to be examined.
Exactly. Yeah, because it's like the total number of people impacted in a relative sense is very small. The scale of the impact on those individuals is extremely high. And I think, though, that because the impact is so significant and so long-term and lasting and can be so incredibly harmful, that it requires us to dig deep into the questions that you're starting to raise. And I think the conversations that you've started to have just recently, like you are right in your process right now around this issue of termination of parental rights and what if. But these questions that you're raising with people are doing something that we talk about on the show a fair amount, like making the invisible visible. Until you heard Corey say, what if TPR wasn't an option? The idea that it is an option, that we can do something different, was invisible to you. And then it became visible. And now the conversations that you're having, that you're creating, like our future is generated through the words that we speak, right? So language is generative, right? So our future is dependent upon the words that people speak. And when leaders speak, it can often have even more impact because of the position that you sit in. So for you to make these things visible for people and create these conversations is the first step in creating a different future. The opportunity here is a couple things. One, to sit with the question even more. Like, we don't have to answer it right away, but if we just really sat with the what if question, what if TPR wasn't an option, and started to get really open and curious and honest and transparent and all of those things, you know, good things are going to come from that. And then I think the other thing in terms of this, you know, 16 families a year having their rights terminated, a small number, but once you start having this what if conversation, what if TPR wasn't an option, it's going to make so many other things visible and open up so many other conversations that the impact of that conversation is going to extend beyond just a termination of parental rights conversation. That to me is what's really exciting as I'm just like thinking with you here. That just that starting point is going to have a focal point to it that's going to get more and more expansive, that it might open up a whole nother set of like what if questions that could take the agency in really different directions.
Yeah, to go all the way back to the beginning, TPR, I think systemically is the default or is the norm, right? Like it has been. And so, you know, that's a massive part of the goal, I think, of the conversations is to move the norm from that to an expectation, an assumption. If the parents truly cannot safely parent their children at this time, that there will be a plan and a community that wraps around the child, that have different levels of responsibility that allow them to stay as connected as possible. And the conversation then becomes, how do we do that? How do we do it legally? How do we do it safely? You know, how do we do it logistically? I think that could be the new norm, if you will. And that's really exciting because that changes not just, right, our conversations about the 16, to your point. It changes the way that we think about the 1,000 families we work with that
exactly. You know,
aren't even court involved or, it moves the needle.
Yeah, because I think what the what if questions and conversations, if you really are open and curious and vulnerable and transparent as leaders and as people working in the system, that set of questions and conversations is going to continue to lead you further and further away from the child welfare system as a necessity? Why do we even need this child welfare system to begin with? You know, what are the other options that are available to us? So I just wonder if you start to feel that or see that it's a TPR question of like, what if it went away? And there's lots of things that you could start working on to move in that direction. But I wonder if it starts to move you and your team and your organization to a place of, what if our role was wildly different as an agency where we weren't intervening in families' lives? What would that look like? I wonder if it'll move you in that direction over time.
Oh, I mean, I'm already there. Mm-hmm. Right. So I feel really strongly that our system needs to shrink. It needs to shrink significantly, in my opinion. And I think that the folks who currently work in the system will still have a role in supporting families. It just will be so different. It won't be, you know, very power imbalanced way that our current agency and legislation creates, but in a community-based way, in a way that allows us to really meet people where they are, help them get what they need, help them bring in the support and the connections that they need. We talk about it all of the time, but truly, what, 13, 15% of what we deal with nationally is abuse, is severe physical harm, is sexual abuse, is the kind of thing that is so incredibly dangerous that an intervention is actually less harmful than the abuse. But the rest of that, so much, I should say, of the rest of our work, I think we have to start asking if the intervention is more harmful than the abuse. I think we know that it is, actually, I would argue, right? Or at least a young person's experience of foster care is more harmful, I think. But I think it opens it up, and that's where I'm at. And it's a really strange place to sit, right? To sit in the system and say these things. And, you know, I don't know if you ever said this. I feel like social workers all the time say, you know, we're going to work ourselves out of a job. And that's the goal, right? And it's like, yeah, but what if we actually do? And people feel very differently when it's real, right? And so there's a lot to consider.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've had people in your role, you know, county directors say to me, the number of kids in foster care is just right. It's the right number. That was very early in my career. And I was like, that doesn't connect. Where that often comes from is the protectionist nature of like, but you know, one, we know how to keep kids safe and that's our job and we have to keep kids safe. And I think we should be questioning whether or not we know how to keep kids safe and if we are keeping kids safe and which kids are we keeping safe and which kids are we not, because we don't pay attention to those communities. So there's a lot of questions around that. And again, it's like, who are we serving? Who are we prioritizing? Whose comfort are we centering in these conversations? And I think we have to particularly people in your seat, Molly, you know, have to really challenge some of these presumptions and norms and culture that we've inherited. But I wonder, as you continue having these conversations and moving in this direction around TPR, there are going to be naysayers along the way. And perhaps there have been already. And it's probably going to be around, but we need to ensure that permanency is available to kids, and we need to keep kids safe from parents that are harmful and dangerous. How do you start to engage in those conversations? Like, how do you engage in the challenge to TPR not being an option?
I think that question is kind of the next question in this process for me, for my team. How do you change the way people think about very deep-rooted values is really, right, another way to ask that question. I think it's by asking them questions, by helping them think critically about why they believe what they believe or why what they're suggesting is in the best interest. I also feel really strongly in the use of data. And so just being very grounded in understanding what data and research are showing us is best for kids. And then I think also through stories, right? So I think I get to see so many parts of the work and I pick up these little anecdotes along the way that just, for me, really demonstrate exactly what we're talking about. I think sharing those and allowing people to kind of feel comfortable, feel confident, feel safe in questioning anything, disagreeing, right? So much of it is around the culture of the organization. And that's a huge part of what we're doing concurrently is really building kind of a growth mindset culture and a learning culture so that people feel comfortable saying, I don't know, or I disagree, or, you know, and that's really hard to do in a bureaucracy, right? In a very regulatory agency. And I'm just so fortunate to be in the place that I am because I have this really brilliant group of people who want to do what's best and are willing to stop and think about things differently or challenge, you know, kind of the way it's always been done. So,
Yeah. And you know, you'll find out how to navigate as you continue to push. Part of what you're getting at there too, that I think about a lot is just the importance of vision and leadership. Mm-hmm. So any organization, there has to be vision. Mm-hmm. And the question of right relationship, the question of who are we centering, you know, the question of who are we serving, you know, should drive our vision. And then the leadership is the ability to follow through on the vision. But I think the thing in the middle that you're bringing up is culture. Mm-hmm. So you can have vision and you can have good leadership and you can be moving in a direction, but if the culture isn't there to support the vision, then you'll never get there. And I think that in child welfare, we have organizational cultures that are embedded in the idea of termination of parental rights as a norm, as adoption as the gold standard, centering foster and adoptive parents as the clients, you know, and then there's, again, these factors of what we measure in terms of federal requirements, financial incentives, like there's so many other factors too that play into the culture and are in addition to the culture. In other words, you know, it's an uphill climb, but it's one that we need to be climbing and striving for. And so I wonder, as you just think, like, again, like you're unpacking the groceries and you have these feelings and these thoughts, you start having some conversations, you start organizing some people around this idea of what if TPR wasn't an option? What's next, do you think? Like, where do you see this going next for you, for the organization?
I think that we will go far more slowly than I like. I like to move quickly, and our bureaucracy exists to create stability in our society, and it's really good at it, right? So change is just incredibly difficult. And I think actually the culture piece, the empowerment piece, is the next step. And so it's doing some prep work, right? It's going slow now to go faster later, because what we know for sure, and one of the things that I both appreciate and get incredibly frustrated about and where I sit in the system, is that I know that a policy change alone will not change the experience of kids and families. Colorado could do away with TPR tomorrow, and the experience of the parents we work with, the children we work with, would not change legally, right? Like TPR wouldn't happen, but I think relationally, nothing would change. Experientially, nothing would change. You know, TPR is one of so many things that we need to talk about in terms of, you know, who we want to be and what we want our system to be. And so it's both about TPR and it's about so much more.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. You know, a policy change is one lever, but it doesn't change the experience that people have necessarily. I think a lot about the six conditions of systems change, right? And so the top three are the structures, policy, practice, and money. But the one at the bottom is the one we never spend real time with, because it's the personal process. It's personal transformation. It's change starts with us. It's the mindset. What is the mindset of the people in the organization that creates the culture or perpetuates the culture? And if we start at the mindset level, which is what you're getting at, then I think we have a better chance at long-term success of actually changing the experience that people have, because then we start to think differently about who we're connected to, who we're in relationship with, who has power to decide what those structures should look like. Those are the other two conditions, right? Relationships and power. But if we start with the mindset and get ourselves to a place where we can be vulnerable and transparent and comfortable with being uncomfortable and ask better questions of ourselves, we might get to a place where we shift who we're connected to, who has power, and what kind of structures we create, what kind of policies we create, and how we implement those policies. So I think, you know, we've got to stay with the questions and stay with the culture and stay with us, like getting us comfortable enough to move off our spot.
Can I put an even finer point on it?
Please.
You know, a huge part of why it's so important in my very specific situation is because that 1% of terminations of families that we terminated rights on wasn't required in any way. Like, we today in Boulder County could say we're no longer going to TPR. And from a policy perspective, from a systems perspective, we would be in compliance. Like, we wouldn't be doing anything wrong. But it's the story of the grandmother's ham, right? Like, cuts top off the ham, little girl says why, says you have to ask grandma. It's because that's how the great grandma did it, because her oven was small. But like, it's just because we've always done it that way. So that's where, for me, like, the culture and the mindset comes in, because so much of the time we're just cutting the top off the ham and we don't realize that we have everything we need systemically, structurally, policy-wise to make this change, because we haven't had the opportunity to slow down, to stop, and to really think and change ourselves.
That's right. I think that's right. That's what leadership can do. So yeah. So this is a process unfolding for you. I mean, you said at the beginning of this conversation that it wasn't that long ago that you heard this question of what if, and it's taken you into some internal places, but it's also moved you to some action around bringing people together to have these questions asked and to have these conversations. So I'm curious, Molly, where it goes next. And I suspect that I'll say, hey, let's hop back on and catch up at some point down the road and see where the process has taken you and the organization and in the community. So hopefully we can do that. But before we wrap it up here, the two questions that we always end with: what does proximity mean to you? And then what advice might you have for me or for the listeners? But yeah, let's start with the first one. So as you sit here today, what does proximity mean to you?
Proximity, right? Just very directly. Proximity means closeness, right? I think, right? And closeness, it's like almost a word association for me. Closeness is about connection. Connection is about relationship. And for me in this work, which is the lens in which I view, you know, so much of our conversation and, you know, this question about proximity, relationship is about values and respect and just a very deep commitment to ensuring that that's the experience that families who have to interact with our system have. So it's like this really, really strange kind of waterfall for me. But ultimately, it is, I think, because this place, this community, this podcast has been a place where I can, you know, be really open and transparent in how I'm thinking about our system. I think it ultimately means, right, the change, the reform, the radical transformation that I hope to see in our system, and all of the connections and relationships, not just that live in that system, but also that I have with, you know, all of the different people who are doing this work.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, I think about this a lot, but, you know, as you kind of went through that progression to relationships, I think a question for all of us is, who are we in relationship with? Mm-hmm. So I think it's an important question. Yeah. How about advice before we close out here?
Well, I really enjoy both the podcast and the community, so thank you for that. You're doing a great job. I'm teasing a little. The one thing that I was thoughtful of, you know, I was thinking like, what could I, you know, give Matt advice on? I wonder if there's an opportunity for us as a group, as a community, as a system, to think about how to do the same kind of conversation at the micro level, right? Because I think our conversations are largely really macro, which makes good sense, right? That's a huge part of this. But I think it is that, like, that piece about how can one of my caseworkers access the same experience in a way that might feel even more real or relevant to them? And it's a challenge, I think, for myself. It's something that I have just started thinking about as I thought about giving you advice, but I thought I'd bring it to you because I think it's really interesting to think about. Because, you know, the average caseworker isn't thinking about CAPTA, right? Like, I get to do that because that's part of my job, but that's not theirs. And so how can we help kind of translate and scaffold some of this so that it feels really accessible and meaningful in their own work and daily lives and process? So that is, I don't know if it's advice, but it's like maybe perhaps an opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah, I love it. And it just makes me think too that, because you do join the podcast club calls pretty frequently. And I wonder if we take that there as a conversation, because a lot of the folks on that call are mid to late career, you know, they're not frontline direct staff that are working with. And I wonder if we have that conversation there of like, how would we translate these kinds of more macro, big picture conversations into something that has more tangible, practical value to somebody that's in the day-to-day, you know, working with families. So yeah, I like that.
It'd be a fun conversation, I think.
Yeah. Great. Yeah. Well, we will, let's do this then. So this episode will air. I forget when exactly, we've got it on the calendar, but you will in all likelihood be the special guest on that following Monday's podcast club call. So we could bring this question to the group. That'd be good.
Love it.
Well, Molly, thank you. This has been good. It's a conversation in process for me, and I think for you of what if. And so thanks for having it. And I'm sure we'll probably come back to it.
Thanks. Love it. Appreciate it very much. Thanks for the opportunity.
All right. So before we wrap up today's episode, just a couple things. One, of course, thanks to Molly for coming on and really for being a little vulnerable, a little open and honest with us about where she is in her process today. It's new, it's unfolding. So really appreciate that, and want to mention our next guest. So we're going to continue this series of TPR conversations. Vivek Sankaran will be our next guest, and many of you might know who he is. He's at the University of Michigan Law School. Among other things, he is working on a case in front of the Michigan Supreme Court on the constitutionality of termination of parental rights. So great episode. Looking forward to that one. If you all want to join the Monday Morning Proximity Podcast Club, you're invited to do so. We meet at 9 a.m. Eastern. Just find me on LinkedIn through the podcast show notes. Send me a message. We'll get you the invite, and you're welcome to join us. And then, of course, lastly, just want to say thanks to our production team. Thank you to Michael Tex Osborne at 14th Street Studios, to Evan Scherer for his production support, and of course, Christian Heiges for original music. Okay, that's it. We'll see you next time. Thank you.